Subscribe to our free podcasts at abc.net.au/rn.
And Natasha Mitchell joining you now on Life Matters here on ABC RN. Welcome indeed. As the G20's leaders summit lands, we're staying intimate this morning. Not so much global, although I want to point out two things that I've caught this week on RN. Big Ideas just aired a great discussion on the G20 meeting in Brisbane and the questions the event raises for civil liberties in Australia. It was really interesting. I listened to it last night. All views aired. Catch up with it on their webpage. And look, while I'm in plug mode, I can't help but plug into the music this Saturday. Love in the 90s, one for the Gen Xers, all about the 90s music scene that brought us the great talents of PJ Harvey and Radiohead and Smashing Pumpkins and more. Tune in. Very excited about that. Coming up on Life Matters, though, talking to your kids about what's happening to grandma or grandpa, or sometimes you, that difficult discussion that we have to have about dementia. Grandchildren, of course, often have a very special, a uniquely close relationship with their grandparents. So they really hone in, they tap into changes in behaviour very quickly. So how do you have that conversation? How have you had that conversation? And how have those relationships changed? We're going to have three guests on the program in about 15 minutes. And we're going to open up the phone lines on this too. We'd love to hear from you this morning. So stay with us and tweet us at RN Life Matters. But first this morning, you might have caught the interview on RN Breakfast. Tim Badman joined Fran from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, the IUCN. The organisation is holding its World Parks Congress in Sydney this week. Biodiversity, conservation, they'll be the big buzzwords. But this is as much about parks and the way we humans engage with them. How accessible are all parks to all people? Well, Dr. David Stratton is a nature lover from way back, as we'll hear. He was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, though, in 1995. Now he's unable to walk. The thing is, that hasn't stopped him from scaling great peaks and getting right in amongst the wilderness. And there's a special tool that has allowed him to do that. It's called the Trail Rider. And he joins us this morning. He really wants all people living with disabilities to have access to this device. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning, Natasha.
We're going to get to this device in a minute. And also, Roz, your wife, is going to join us in a minute too. But let's just go right back and get to the heart of this and the heart of this connection that you formed early on with the wilderness. Where did it begin?
Well, I grew up in Europe, England to be precise, you can probably tell. Mm-hmm. And my parents went often to Maud's Mountains and kind of dragged me along. I can remember being a bit reluctant. I can remember being on a Scottish hillside and looking at them receding into the distance. I must have been about five and realizing that ultimately I just had to get out there and keep up with them. And I think that's when the penny dropped. And since then, I've delighted in being in high places.
What did it bring to your life? Because you were an academic, you were originally an engineer, and then I think you went and did a PhD in the IT field. So there was a whole other world that you were living. But what did this bring your world?
Yes, I think you've hit the right tone with the other world. It is a completely other world. It's away from all those technical, mechanical things, computers, for example, and out into complete, untouched wilderness. I mean, it's touched to the extent there's a trail that you can walk along, but it's pretty, pretty special.
When this diagnosis landed in your life, how did that feel?
It was not the best piece of news I've had in my life.
Putting it mildly.
Yes, but at the same time, it was a very long, slow thing, so I had plenty of time to get used to each depredation, if you like. Things would get worse, but only ever slowly. So I could learn to walk with a walking stick and learn to be in a wheelchair and learn to be in a trail rider.
Yes, well, we'll get to the trail rider. So this was introduced to you in 2009. And really, you had not been able to navigate wilderness once you landed in a wheelchair.
Absolutely not.
You can navigate a lot of the world in a wheelchair, but it's very hard to scale a peak in the bush in a wheelchair.
It's the problem of having four wheels, and you just imagine pushing a wheelchair over a rocky path. The four wheels can end up working against each other. You get jammed against obstacles, and the trail rider has one wheel, and you get completely around that.
Yeah, describe this device, this all-terrain wheelchair for us. Just paint the picture.
Okay. Well, the one wheel is like a wheelbarrow wheel. It essentially is a wheelbarrow wheel. Big fat tire, but it's got handles at the corner, and I often talk about a sedan chair that the kings of France, I imagine, being carried around by four courtiers, except the four courtiers would have to carry the weight of the king. The one wheel means that I can be king, and my guides don't have to carry my weight. All they have to do is lever me, pull me along the path.
So you've got a crew of trusty Sherpas or volunteers.
That's right.
Helpers.
Yes, Sherpas, we call them, yes. Like the people in the Himalayas that help you up the Himalayan mountains.
I'll get to the impact of what this has meant for you, but what was it? Were you sceptical initially?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely,
yes.
Right.
Oh, my God. It was a friend in Canada. And she showed me online pictures of people in these things. And one wheel it sounds terrible. It's a terrible idea. I've made it sound attractive just now, but it looks as if you are helpless.
It's like a big stretcher with a wheel.
Yes, yeah, that's
but upright.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
So this is where Roz enters the story. Your partner in life, your wife, Roz Hart. Welcome to the show, Roz.
Oh, hi, Natasha.
You were very keen for David to try this device.
Yes, well, Dave is an incredibly brave person, and I was surprised by how reticent he was. And he was saying, no, I'll be in the hands of, I'll have no control. And I was saying to him, because we used to walk up mountains together. That was how we spent our holidays. And we walked the Cotswold Way together. And it was our delight to be out in beautiful places in nature. And it was a great sadness to me that we couldn't do these things together. I had to go by myself.
It's not discussed, this aspect, when a partner has a chronic illness, how much it truncates both of your lives and the adventures that you'd been used to having.
Well, it's part of the grief. It's a deep grief that is very rarely spoken about, that you have to stop doing the things that you loved to do together. And when Donna, our friend in Vancouver, we used to live in Vancouver, she said, I'm hiring this contraption for you. And Dave was saying, no, I'm not going to, no, I can't. And I was saying, Dave, you are going to do this. And I was bossy. And he looked at me and he said, okay. And Dave, you can say how you felt, how long it took for you to fall in love with it.
Yes, okay, Dave, take us to that first
love
effort.
Love at first sight, yes. it wasn't love at first sight when I met Rose, but it was love at first sight when I met the trail rider.
But it's such a different way of navigating the wilderness, isn't it? Because you've basically got to have a crew of people lifting you over those rocks and fallen logs and any number of obstacles.
It is, and what you need is an incredible amount of trust in that crew, which is something I never spoke enough about that, but Roz experienced that recently for herself.
Yeah, Roz, you've just had your first go recently, I think, though you've been promoting this and trying to get these international parks around Australia. But what was the sensation like for you?
Well, it hadn't occurred to me with our friends Joanne and Rodney come with us everywhere, and the three of us are part of the Sherpa team, and our children, our hearty and healthy adult children and their partners. And just recently in the Grampians, we were there helping to promote the Sherpa volunteer program and to launch that volunteer program. And because we were training volunteer Sherpas, we had Parks Victoria had two trail riders there. And I said to them at the end of a trail, I wonder if I can have a little girl. And this is after years, because we've only ever had one trail rider. So I got into this thing, and I didn't realise, David never explained, how absolutely beautiful the sensation is. It feels like being rocked in the womb.
Oh.
It is the most comforting, comfortable, beautiful feeling of surrendering to the Sherpas, but also the trail ride itself is enormously comfortable. And I thought, I don't want to get out of this.
What a lovely description of it. Ros Hart there, and Dr. David Stratton is with us this morning, her husband, I should say. And we're talking about, on the occasion of the World's Parks Congress in Sydney, a very big gathering, international gathering, hosted by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, talking about a device called the Trail Rider, because David was diagnosed with MS many years ago now. It meant that he was no longer able to move through the wilderness as he loved to do with his partner. Now, there are a kind of growth, I've noticed, of wheelchair-friendly paths in some parks, David. They're often very short, so I'm just wondering what the distinction is for you, how this is different for you, this kind of device that allows you to move much further.
Yes, exactly. Particularly Parks Victoria do an amazing job of making parks accessible to people on four-wheeled wheelchairs. But those trails are obviously wide and smooth and quite short and crowded. There's lots of people out there. So it is a wilderness experience, but only the very edge of one.
So you've been advocating very heavily, and Parks Victoria sound like they've got right on board. They've been quite innovative around improving accessibility, as you point out. But give us a sense then of how widespread these devices are.
Well, there are 16 now in Australia. Most of them are in Parks Victoria, but there's one in Perth. There's one in Tasmania at Cradle Mountain, which incidentally, you mentioned earlier, a stretcher. They got their trail rider to use for mountain rescue. Rather than use a stretcher, they use a trail rider.
Ah, so multiple uses.
Yes, yes, it's extraordinary.
Is 16 enough?
No, absolutely not. I think this is just the beginning, because there are so many incredible, beautiful places. Northern Territory, Kings Canyon are thinking of getting one. So it's moving along at quite an astonishing pace, thanks largely to Parks Victoria, who really have this idea of getting disability access to their parks very, very keen in their minds and in the way their organisation is structured.
Now, of course, and just to touch on this, because you've got six adult children, I gather, to Sherpa you on your trail rider. Is that true?
Yes. Yes.
Most people aren't going to have that kind of level of commitment. So to what extent is this about also advocating for trained volunteers, and who do those volunteers need to be?
Yes, they need a degree of fitness. I mean, if you go on a levelish path, two people can be Sherpas. So it's not necessarily extraordinarily hard work, but you need fitness. You need a love of nature, I think. So people who love to go out in the wilderness anyway are very natural potential volunteers, and as a volunteer Sherpa, they will be helping. I've heard a volunteer Sherpa say this: I love being out in the wilderness, but even better, I love the idea that I can help somebody get out there that couldn't otherwise get out there.
And where's your MS at now?
Well, I'm a permanent wheelchair person. I don't go anywhere on my own 2 feet. And I'm at the stage of MS where that is only going to get worse, but I'm going to go down having an amazing time in nature.
And Roz, where's the next adventure?
Look, being here at the Congress has been a great adventure, we go there for the first time this morning. We're at Olympic Park right now in Homebush in Sydney, but we had to drive here because Dave is his disability is so severe now that we can't fly, so it's been quite a trek to drive up here with three wheelchairs and all the other equipment and odds and sods, but our friends Joe and Rodney Parks Victoria have helped us to bring them up as well, and because I need that help with Dave's care needs, and so that's just looking at today, Natasha, and looking forward to today.
Well, it sounds like every leg is an adventure. David, have you got something to add?
Yes, I was going to add, when you asked where's the next adventure, I was thinking of Kilimanjaro, where the trail rider has been, and Everest Base Camp, where the trail rider has also been, but I know we're not going there.
I don't know about this. Roz, what's your response to that? How potent have these and energetic have these conversations been?
Natasha, my laughter is hysterical laughter.
Yes, I noticed a hint of hysteria there.
Look, we love going to Wilson's Prom. We love because there's a trail rider at Wilson's Prom. There's a trail rider in the Grampians, which is close by near where we live. And I'm really yeah. happy to live.
Keep it local. Keep it local. Just before I let you go, how much do they cost?
By the time they're in Australia, they're made in Vancouver, by the time they're in Australia, about $7,000.
Not cheap, just like wheelchairs, expensive. And wheelchairs Indeed. Are, of course, much more expensive than that. People don't realise that. They assume that people get them for free. And, yes, they don't.
Natasha, can I say one more thing?
Very briefly.
We're going home via Canberra, and there's one at Tidbinbilla, so we're going there to help them out as
Is there
well.
A place where there's a list of all these things?
Yes, it would be my blog.
Okay.
My blog address is trailridertales.blogspot.com. That's all one word,
okay.
Trailridertales.
I think we might have included a link to that on the Facebook on our website, but we certainly will. Dr. David Stratton, Roz Hart, have a great week at the World Parks Congress in Sydney, and thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters this morning to talk about Trail Rider.
Thank you very much, Natasha.
And David has made a short video about his experiences with Parks Victoria and with the trail rider. It's called Wild Places, and we'll put it on our website. And just a heads up, tomorrow we're going to bring you a repeat talkback because it was incredibly popular with Jackie French. Let the Land Speak. Really connected with this theme of our love of wilderness and what it can give our lives. Jackie French, the wonderful, wombat-loving, garden-loving Jackie French on tomorrow. And you're with Life Matters now on RN. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. Pleased to be here with you. We're going to take your calls next about something very, very delicate but also very important, that relationship between grandchildren and their grandparents when dementia sets in.
Did you know that right underneath the heart of Sydney's CBD, there's a lake? It's over a kilometre long and 6 metres deep in part, right next to the City Circle railway line in an unfinished tunnel. Rumour has it that the army sends troops down there to train in complete darkness.
Hello.
And there's a huge albino eel which pops up when you least expect it. Off track. Saturday at 1.
What's happening to Grandpa? Why can't he remember my name anymore? Why can't Grandma live at home anymore? Navigating your changing relationship with loved ones as dementia sets in is hard enough, but children have to grapple with these changes too. And in some cases, it's their parents rather than grandparents who are living with the illness. in the case of early onset dementia. Is this something you've experienced and that you've had to explain to your children to navigate with them? Joining us shortly, three guests, but we'd really like to hear from you this morning too. I wonder what approach you've taken when a loved one has been diagnosed with dementia and their behaviour starts to change with your children. What issues have come up? Have you tried to protect a child from the knowledge and perhaps sadness of the situation, or found a way of talking about it? And I wonder how your children have navigated the changes in their grandparent or parents' behaviour, and also in their relationship, because of course grandchildren have a very close relationship with their grandparents often, so they're right tapped into any changes going on. Or perhaps you were a child whose grandparent or parent had dementia. What do you remember about what you felt at the time? Give us a call this morning, 1300 225 76, or 1300 CALL RN. If you're in New South Wales, Victoria, Canberra, Tassie, call right now. Queensland, Northern Territory, South Australia, WA. Time zones being what they are, best to go for our listener feedback line, 0283 1430. So the talkback number again, 1300 225 76, or you can text us 0418 226 576. Tweet us at RN Life Matters. So many ways to get in touch, and some of you already are on our Facebook page. But I'd like to introduce my guests. First up, journalist and children's author Victoria Lane. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Tasha.
Victoria is the author of a new book called Celia and Nonna, to really give voice to this relationship between grandparent and grandchild. Also with us is Bridget Brody. She's a counsellor and therapist for families living specifically with early onset dementia. Good morning to you, Bridget.
Good morning, Natasha. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you there. And Jared is with us too. He's popped right out of work to join us for a few minutes of our discussion today. His father had dementia as he was growing up, and so he's got very particular insights into this experience. Thanks so much, Jared.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you with us. Victoria, a bright and beautiful picture book, Celia and Nonna. What does it describe?
Well, it's told through the eyes of Celia, who's the little girl, and it starts off with all the lovely things that she loves doing at her grandmother's house, obviously getting spoiled rotten, and then something changes. And it's really about how Celia navigates that change and what she can do to still make that relationship special with her grandma.
It starts with Celia loves sleepovers at Nonna's house. This is personal to you, isn't it?
Yes, look, it's a bit of a tapestry, really, of my personal experience. So it started off with that line in the past tense, she used to love sleepovers at Nonna's. And really, there was a really strong sense of nostalgia or loss for all the beautiful things they used to do together and couldn't do anymore. But obviously, I didn't want the whole story to be about loss. And so I really worked hard, and Celia works hard, to turn it into a positive story.
It is a positive story, and it's helped very much by those gorgeous, colourful, intimate illustrations by Kayleen West. And it is that intimacy between granddaughter and grandparent that you convey, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I was really trying to capture. And obviously there was a sense for me when my eldest daughter could no longer have the sleepovers at her grandmother's house because of my mother's own illness. There were all these things that they were suddenly missing. And then we also had the nursing home experience on the other side when my father went into a nursing home. And just trying to explain that to a young child, and I had a baby at the time as well. It was a very difficult experience.
A lot going on.
Yeah.
What questions did your daughter have, or what observations did she make?
Well, she was probably 3 to 4 at the time when Dad was diagnosed with Parkinson's. We didn't really know that there would be dementia associated with that at the same time. Mm. Look, I think the whole nursing home is a very challenging environment for kids. There was the funny smell. There was, you know, suddenly a large group of much older people. And really the main question was, you know, why can't he still be at home? Why does he need to move?
Yes, indeed. And then there's the whole story of going into a home, and that's a whole other set of questions to navigate too.
That's right. You know, it's such a foreign experience. And, you know, the first thing, being a journalist, the first thing I did was try to do some research and try to find some children's books that talk about dementia or talk about nursing homes, and it turns out there are actually very few of them.
Which is surreal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and that's, you know, in the end, that's what the story ended up being about, although, you know, dementia is never named as the topic.
Yeah. Kate has written on our Facebook page, "Grandma has a sickness in her head that makes her forget things. The doctors can't make her better. It's really sad for all of us, especially for Pa. Little kids and their mummies and daddies are too young to get this type of sickness," which is not the case in Jared's case. And I'll come to you in a moment, Jared. But were you open with what was happening to your parents, your daughter's grandparents?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think it's really important to keep the kids involved and sort of up to date with, you know, even though they're so little, trying to explain it in terms that they can understand. And, you know, I talked about it really in terms of old age, you know, old age and sickness. I didn't use any sort of real big medical terms, but we also didn't have a lot of, you know, medical information as well. And this is what's happening. And, you know, it's sad, but, you know, the thing you tell kids, you know, everything has a life, everything begins, has a life, and that ends at some point.
Mm. We're taking your calls this morning. Victoria Lane is with us. She's the author of a beautiful book illustrated by Kayleen West called Celia and Nonna. We're talking about how dementia might have affected the relationships that your children have with your parents in particular, that and the language you might have found to use to explain to your children what's happening to Nana or Pa. And I wonder if you were a child growing up with a family member diagnosed with dementia, how did you navigate that? What do you remember about that feeling and also the changing nature of your relationship? Also with us this morning is Jared. And in your case, Jared, your dad became unwell with Alzheimer's disease early on in his life, didn't he?
Correct, yeah. He was diagnosed at the age of about 52. And I guess like a lot of people, and, you know, as we've found in the with Alzheimer's, is that it hadn't really been talked about younger onset. And so I distinctly remember when Dad got the diagnosis, there wasn't this overly panicking state amongst our family, because we sort of didn't really understand the implications of that. We hadn't heard a lot about younger onset, knew about dementia, but it was always thought of as just the ageing person's disease.
How old were you?
At the time, I think I was about 20 at the time, 1920, yeah.
Yeah. What was happening for your dad? What were those early signs?
The early signs, I mean, leading up to his diagnosis, you know, he worked, he had an office job, and I distinctly remember, actually, coming home from work. Well, I came home from being out, and he was at home on a day that he had been at work, and he was in tears with Mum, and just we couldn't understand what was going on. He couldn't understand what was going on. He was saying that he just couldn't focus at work. You know, he's forgetting basic things, and it just went on from there. It progressed, and, you know, that situation occurred a number of times, and yes, he ended up going to the doctors and walking out with a diagnosis of dementia.
Yeah, it's hard to fathom, isn't it? And you have some younger siblings too. How did they navigate the changes? Because we're talking about small children as well today, and you know, and the changing nature of the relationship with a parent or grandparent when dementia sets in.
I've got two younger brothers. I've also got an older sister. But yeah, two younger brothers, and there's a tough one. My youngest brother, he was 13. I think, yeah, 12 or 13 when Dad got diagnosed. So just starting high school, just becoming a teenager, so going through all those sort of pressures as well. And,
yeah.
I can honestly say I think he suffered the most out of all of us, mainly because, you know, the attention that would have been on him, you know, nurturing attention that would have been on him throughout his, you know, his teenage life had to be, you know, put onto Dad, his care. My mum, you know, working part-time, is also working full-time to care for Dad. So, very severely affected him. I mean, he's, you know, come through the end of it, and he's doing well now. But, I can honestly say that he suffered the most out of all of us, just having to try and live some sort of teenage normality.
Yeah. Has he talked about that? Does he talk about the impact that it had?
Yes, there are very rare occasions. There's only a few people he will open up. He's a very intelligent kid, and he sort of keeps his thoughts to himself a lot of the time, but he does open up to a certain few people. Yeah.
Well, we'll respect that and we won't probe further there. But for you, yeah, that's right. Jared, how did your relationship shift with your father? And I'm sorry to hear that your dad died in February this year. How did your relationship with shift with him over those years?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, you know, before the dementia, me and my dad had a very close relationship. My dad was a very loving, very, very family man. You know, all our sporting commitments and things like that, he was always the one taking us there and volunteering to help and very much loved us and got involved in that sense. So I had a very close relationship. Post-diagnosis, so as I said before, because we didn't really know a whole lot about it and didn't know what to expect with the change in him, it became not somewhat strained, but lots of frustration. Everyone always, the one thing we're always told is, you know, don't get angry at your father, get angry at the dementia, but yeah. It was very hard to distinguish those two things, especially as the disease progressed and he got worse and worse and was still at home, it got very, very hard for all of us. It was hell for a couple of years there, really. Yeah.
It's tough, isn't it? What do you think now might have helped you as a young man and your siblings as younger kids navigate what was happening to your dad and to your family?
Again, another tough one. I've been involved in, you know, some discussions with Alzheimer's Australia Victoria on such topics, and I know for me personally, anyway, I would have liked to look for different avenues to try and get on with my own life. Our lives become full time consumed with a father having dementia, and. And the one thing that I know myself and my siblings were after was just some sort of outlet, some way to think, okay, we also have a future. We're not, you know, our lives just aren't, you know, sitting and watching our dad deteriorate. We wanted some future. And so things like,
some respite.
Some respite, some avenues to, you know, like, what do I do about, you know, a career that I want to follow or whatever. It was sort of, you know, that had to be put on the back burner. And when I say it had to be, I don't think it had to be, but we thought it did.
Yeah, that is so important. And I wonder how your family together reflects on it all now that your father has died.
Yeah, it's a lot better now, and I guess the one thing with Alzheimer's and dementia is that as you go, we know that he's not going to get better, so you come to terms with them being gone before they've actually died, and so as you said, he passed away in February this year, and although it was still a sad occasion, it wasn't a shock. It was something that we prepared for, and it made things a lot easier afterwards that we could just sort of sit down and reflect on the times before he was diagnosed, and we are all, I can honestly say, we're all at a lot more peace about our lives and what we thought of Dad. Yeah,
it's a release, almost.
Yeah, it was, absolutely.
Yeah, and many people will remind us that being diagnosed with dementia, you still have many years of quality life as well. It's and that's important and vital to remind people as well. It's different for every person, isn't it?
Mm.
Jared, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you've had to dash out of work to do this.
Oh, no, I appreciate getting some time away from work.
Yeah. talking about tough stuff, but I'm really grateful. And we'll let you go and you can catch up with the conversation on our website. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Jared there, he's talking about, well, he and his siblings had the experience of his father being diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease at 52. His dad died this year. And this morning on Life Matters, we are talking about the effects of a diagnosis of dementia in a grandparent or a parent on children. And the number to call is 1300 225 56, or 1300 call RN. Bridget Brody is with us. She's a counsellor and a therapist. Bridget, I'm going to come to you in just a moment. And sure. We just heard from Jared, and we've also got Victoria Lane, who's the author of a new book called Celia and Nonna. But I'd like to take a couple of your calls. Kate in Tasmania, good morning to you.
Hello,
how are you? You're right here now today talking about this in your household.
Yes, we're actually putting my mother into permanent care today. Mm. So it's a big day.
Big day.
But we've been caring for her for almost 5 years. And we actually moved down from New South Wales to take on the role, which we didn't know was going to happen at the time. But that's just how it all unfolded.
And how has it unfolded?
Yes. Oh, well, that's a long story. I might write a book, actually, about that. But
for your children in particular?
Yeah. My youngest was 3 and my oldest was 9, and then the middle one was 7 when we came down. And so they're all 4 years older now, obviously, and there's a big difference in them in 4 years, and they've had a gradual adjustment to what's happened. But it's brought out a very sensitive side in them, and in a way I think it's made them realise that it's important to care for someone in your family, you know, when these sort of things happen. I must say I have avoided the word dementia because I have my own issues with that word.
Why have you avoided that word?
I find the word just has that connotation of, you know, mad, you've lost your mind, and, you know, and even though that is what it is eventually, it's, mum was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, so I tend to use that, even though that's a really hard word to come to terms with as well.
It's the name of a person, so I guess you can kind of personalise it in some ways.
Well, maybe, and it doesn't, it still has that stigma, but it's not this, you know, the same for me as dementia.
How have you described what's happening to mum, to your kids? But, I mean, I guess
memory,
they've lived closely with it.
Yeah, and that her memory is just going, and it's getting worse, and they've noticed it, you know. And so I try to talk about it, especially when it's not that good, you know, when it's a lot more difficult, and get them to talk about it.
And so, how do they feel about today and her going into care? Is that another conversation that you've had to have? Because Victoria Lane thinks that's a vital aspect of all this too, and that's very much a big part of her story, as Celia and Nonna. Nonna does go into care, and Celia has a very important role to play in that story, which I'll get to Victoria about in a tick.
Yes. Yeah, look, we're taking it as it comes. It's an adjustment for everyone, and we've literally had to make this decision in a few days because she ended up in hospital last week, and I was informed by the hospital, well, you know, it's time. And we were actually at that point about a year ago when something else happened, and it just you get to a point you just know that it's time, as hard as it is.
Good luck, Kate.
Yes. Thank you.
Really great to have your call today, and I hope you do write that book.
Thanks very much. Okay.
Thank
Bye.
You. Samantha, interesting, from Victoria. Kate wants to write a book about her experience, and in some ways I wonder if you relate, because you've had to talk through your own trauma with your children when your mum got dementia.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll write a book about it.
Yeah.
Sure, I could feel a book. But the main thing for me, with my kids, you know, my mum and dad live half an hour away, and they would visit us. And mum was diagnosed 2 years ago, and she's had a really rapid decline. When she was diagnosed, it brought up a lot of trauma from the past. So mostly her diagnosis and her deterioration had a huge impact on me, and that was affecting my children.
Yes.
So every time I saw her, I would have to go for long walks to sort of walk out the grief or the rage or the fear or whatever it was, and I had lots of memories surfacing from the past, lots of past trauma. Sort
As your mum loses her memories, some memories become more acute for you.
And her disappearance was reminiscent of disappearances in my life. as I grew up.
Did you talk about that then with your children? Because they would have seen your grief and your grief becomes their grief.
Well, exactly. I did have to speak with it, with my children about it a lot because, and I spoke about it in general terms, you know, I'm worried about, you know, Gran and, you know, and it's making me sad and she's my mum and blah, blah, blah. But also, I had to speak especially to my eldest son, who I think really picked up a lot on my very deep distress and really had to talk through with him as things came up and just keep reiterating that it was okay, I was okay, Lin Lin was okay, she was going to, you know, she was going to eventually die, but she was surrounded by people that she loved, she was well cared for, that I was well loved and well cared for, and that it was a grown-up problem, and that he, you know, and he wasn't to worry too much about it and that kind of thing.
What a process. And I know your mum is now in full-time care, so all the best to you and your family. And I think people will be listening to your call and feeling it very strongly if they've had this experience too. Thank you, Samantha.
Okay, bye-bye.
Really appreciate the call. This morning on Life Matters, we are talking about what happens when a parent or a grandparent is diagnosed with dementia. How does the relationship with the grandchildren or the children change? And what sorts of conversations have you found yourself having with those children? Perhaps in response to questions or observations that they're making. I'll come back to you in a tick, Victoria Lane, but I really want to bring Bridget Brody into the conversation now, counsellor and therapist for families living with early onset dementia. That call from Samantha. Oh, you must deal with this quite a lot, and also hearing Jared's story, very familiar to you.
Absolutely, Natasha, and I think one of the points that both Samantha and the previous caller raised was really about how, as adults, when we're talking to children about these very sensitive issues, how we check in with ourselves first about our own feelings and reactions to the topic, because we know that that has an impact on the way children receive the information and then shapes, I guess, their way of coping.
And that's easier said than done, though, isn't it?
Because
that's a whole other process, working out your own relationship to the parent who has dementia, let alone what's happening for your children or your parents' grandchildren.
That's right. I think what's interesting is that children, that they're often a lot more black and white about these sensitive topics than we are as we grow into our adulthood. And sometimes they, I mean, we know from developmental psychology that children really benefit from being given honest facts. And so when we take ambiguity out of the question and the, you know, and provide children with something factual that they can understand, grandma's brain's not working properly, it's affecting the way she thinks and behaves. Oh, okay, they can make sense of that. And I guess sometimes there can be a desire to protect children from information and potentially underestimate their resilience to cope with the information that we give them.
Jared's story of them all being very young when their father, who was also very young, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's is a unique scenario, isn't it? What is unique about that for children? Because, and I thought the point he made about his little brother, who was 13 when the diagnosis came in, was very interesting, because that is, he was at a key developmental stage.
That's right. I think what is unique about the children of parents with younger onset dementia is that they often feel as though they're losing a parent who would have been there to provide them with age-appropriate nurturing, guidance, let's talk about your career, let's go out for driving lessons, those sorts of things are often lost. And even if the family has another parent present who doesn't have the diagnosis, they're often so, understandably so, preoccupied with the care of their partner that the children often miss out on the level of attention that they may have otherwise received from their parents.
Yeah. So what can people do? What can families do?
Well, at Alzheimer's Australia, Vic, we provide family counselling services. I work particularly within a program that's supporting people with younger onset dementia, that being people who are diagnosed before the age of 65. But we do also provide support services to people across the board who are living with dementia. I guess...
So connect with Alzheimer's New South Alzheimer's Victoria, Alzheimer's Australia Victoria, Alzheimer's Australia New South Wales.
That's right. As part of a federated organisation, we're replicated around each state and territory in Australia.
Yeah.
And usually the first point of call for families would be the National Dementia Helpline. Natasha, I can provide that number, or it might be linked on your
We'll give it on our website. Let me come back to Victoria. Victoria, listening to these calls, so much to say, and I want to take some more calls before we finish up. But Celia has a very particular role to play when Nonna goes into care, doesn't she?
Yes, that's right. I really think Celia sort of finds her own way to make this time together sort of very special. And the way she does that is through art and creativity. So she starts to draw these lovely pictures. So they not only decorate the walls of this bare room, but they also help to revive memories for her grandma. And that section of the book is really colourful and warm. And if you can see the illustrations from Kayleen West, they sort of ooze with love, one person told me.
And life. And that's there's been incredible research around the cognitive impact for people with Alzheimer's who are living in care of having photos, having cognitive props and scaffolding around them, pictures by children and hints of their life that was.
Absolutely. And I certainly think something that the callers have all really talked about today is you have that filter as a parent. So you've got not only the relationship with your own parents, but that is also filtered with how your children are feeling. And it's almost a double sense of loss as you see your parents go through this for that relationship with your own kids and for the grandparents.
Yes. Let's take a call from David in Victoria. David, your grandmother had dementia. What was that experience like for you?
Very traumatic, actually. I'd been very close to her. We'd been very close when I was a child, but my father was away during the war, and my grandmother ran the local Comforts Fund where the ladies were knitting socks and things, and she was secretary of the local branch of the Red Cross and had led a very active life. And then after her husband died, my grandfather... And she was living with my aunt. She started to have violent arguments with my aunt.
Right, so her behaviour changed quite dramatically.
Yes, and then she started forgetting people's names, and she mishandled money. She was buying food at the shopping centre that she didn't need. And my mother then produced a mum. I said to mum, you know, what's happened with mum? And she said, oh, she's got senile dementia. And to me, that sounded like absolute madness, and I couldn't accept that.
And it's left an imprint, obviously.
Yeah, and she lived halfway between the city and where my parents were living, and I'd call in to see her frequently, particularly on a Friday if I was going to stay the weekend with my parents. And I was in my late 30s by this stage. And Mum had given her a little red notebook and written down all the names of the family. And I called in there one day and said hello to her, and she looked up rather vaguely at me, then opened the notebook, ran her finger down the page till she got to my name. She said, you? And I said, yes, of course.
Oh, David. Thank
and
you
then,
so...
And then ultimately she had to go to... When she couldn't manage, Mum and Dad put her into a home, and where she was very well looked after, and she seemed quite comfortable for a while. And I think I was the last person she spoke to. I called in there one evening, and she said to me, oh, she said, you know, I'm just a stupid old fool. I just can't die.
David, thank you so much for sharing. Thank you so much for sharing the memory today. And it's obviously left a big imprint on you. David in Victoria there, a deep and long memory of his grandmother and when she was diagnosed. Marie in Tasmania, finally to you. Your
Hello.
Son was six when Grandpa had this experience.
Yes, so his grandfather, so his paternal grandfather succumbed to dementia and subsequently died, and my son was about 6 or 7. But what I wanted to share is the strength and power of intergenerational stories in helping children find peace. Of course, he was really sad and he was watching his father's sadness. But what helped him was talking with me, so it wasn't my father, talking with me about my grandmother's insight. So she didn't succumb to dementia, but she lived a long life. But she talked to us about being ready. Mm. And she would say, oh, I've lived a long life. I've seen all my beautiful children and all, sorry, you beautiful grandchildren grown up.
Yeah.
And I was able to talk with my son about my grandmother's insight, and that helped him understand that, yes, it's sad, but there's also a time. And he could find peace through his grief and his love of his father and his grief about his grandfather. And so those intergenerational stories are so important for children to hear and to be able to weep. And he got some wisdom from my grandmother, and I'm grateful to her for that. The other thing, I'll be really quick, I wanted to share is there's a beautiful story. I think it's illustrated by Mem Fox, called Wilfred Gordon MacDonald Partridge. And it's a story of dementia and a little boy who discovers dementia, and I recommend it. It's just gorgeous.
Mem Fox, Marie in Tassie, thanks so much, very much. That's a great a comment. And just very briefly and finally to you, Bridget Brody and Victoria Lane, it's all about talking, isn't it? And there you go, that's Marie reinforced that point, that intergenerational storytelling as well.
Look, I think, Natasha, the point was beautifully illustrated about the potential for there to be great strength in families and opening up the discussions. Children's storybooks are a wonderful resource for parents to be able to begin opening up those discussions and having open communication. I think what's also been a thought of mine reflecting on the calls that have come through is that there's been a lot of talk about the stigma associated with dementia from our callers, and we know that currently and in generations gone by, that stigma has certainly surrounded the condition. Mm. But what a potential for children to change that stigma if we are able to call it dementia or Alzheimer's disease or whichever type of dementia it is and provide the children with that name. I guess it really brings about a sense of hope for me that the children and future generations might be able to just say, oh, yeah, that person has a disorder that affects their brain. It's called dementia. That's okay.
That's an interesting point that you make there. Victoria Lane, very briefly and finally to you. We've only got about 10 seconds.
Thanks so much, Natasha. I really do hope that Celia and Anna can sort of start that conversation for families and just help people who are going through these similar situations.
Yeah, Celia and Anna, beautiful book. Victoria Lane joining us, Bridget Brody joining us too, counsellor and therapist for families living with early onset dementia particularly. She works with Alzheimer's Australia Victoria, and the national helpline for Australia, Alzheimer's Australia is 1800 100 500 1800 100 500, the website fightdementia.org.au, and Victoria's got a great website as well, a blog, and with details of Celia and Nonna, we'll link to that. Just enough time to squeeze in a few of your calls, and it's actually, well, I guess it links particularly in response to last Friday's talk back and our relationship to ageing, dying, evolving. When do we say enough is enough? Here's a call.
I'm 94, very, very soon. I'd like to say, I think it depends enormously on one's attitude to death. I don't want to sound prim or clever, but for a great part of my life, and now especially, I do not fear death, and I just live the now and trust that in the end, all will be well, because I believe that neither death nor life no, any other thing can separate us from the love of God, which has sustained me for 93 and three-quarter years. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Kathy. I'm just ringing about my husband who died before he was 60, and the discussion about prolonging life. He would have taken any means to prolong his life, but he was a highly creative filmmaker, and what he contributed later in life was he was allowed to rest, contemplate what he had achieved, and also help others, the sort of things that he wasn't really able to do at all when he was hugely busy as a creative filmmaker. So I think even at the end, people can contribute a great deal. It may not be so active, and obviously it really does depend on the person. But for him, I think he would have contributed as he did right to the end and loved every single second of it. Thanks.
Oh, and thank you. And we got many more calls besides. I was hoping to get to a few more of them today. We might try and squeeze them in, certainly next week. And our listener feedback line is 0283 1430. Please keep the conversation going on our Facebook page about dementia and children. And you can also get on our website and do the same. abc.net.au/rn. And look for Life Matters. Park yourself on the RN homepage while you're there. Always new features going up there. And next on Life Matters, actually, we're going to bring you the repeat of a great talkback that we did some time ago now with Jackie French. Yes, that wonderful wombat lover, garden lover, Let the Land Speak is her latest book, and she joined us for the full hour. It was so popular, we'd like to bring it to you again, and it's kind of relevant given that there's that big Parks Congress on in Australia. Well, bye from me, Natasha Mitchell. Thanks for today. Coming up to the news now on RN.